Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 21st, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:03 p.m. Today we have Vice Chair Wright, Representative Allard, myself, Chair Shaw, and if you could, committee members and those in the audience, turn off your cell phones or silence them. Andy Goodenough is with our House Records, Talia Ames with LIO, Reese Williams is my committee aide to help us along the way. The committee time today will be solely devoted to reviewing the governor's appointments. The House State Affairs Committee has been tasked with reviewing the Lieutenant Governor's successor, Major General Torrance Sachs, as well as appointments to the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, Marijuana Control Board, State Board of Parole, Personnel Board, Alaska Police Standards Council, and the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. The vast majority of these appointees will be appearing before the committee via teleconference. Thank you, Representative Story, for joining us. I'm going to open public testimony today at the end of today's meeting. If there are any members of the public who want to weigh in on these appointments, they can call in after we've gone through all of the introductions. First up is Lieutenant Governor's successor. We'll begin with the governor's appointment of Major General Torrance Sachs as a Lieutenant Governor's successor. Alaska Statute 44-19.040 directs the governor to appoint from among the administrative officers a successor to the Lieutenant Governor's position, subject to confirmation in a joint legislative session. Major General Sachs is with us here today, and if I could ask General Sachs to come forward to the presenter's table. A person appointed to succeed the Lieutenant Governor must, of course, meet the qualifications at the Office of Lieutenant Governor and Governor. So, General, there's just a couple of questions I'd like to ask in advance of your presentation. I'm assuming you're at least 30 years old.
I am over 30 years old.
Sort of following the script here. You've been a citizen of the United States for the last 7 years.
I have.
For the record, thank you. And you're qualified to vote in the state of Alaska.
I am.
Have you been a resident of the state of Alaska for at least 7 years?
I have.
Thank you. Please tell us about your experience and your background, and then we'll take questions to General Sachs. Please, sir.
Enlisted in the Army. I was a private a long time ago, and I've been in the military ever since. So going through, I was in the reserves and had a deployment with the Army, and then active duty for quite a while. I've had 7 commands over the years, and I've been in the National Guard since 2004. So I've been a base commander, currently the commissioner of DMVA, and oversee the Youth Academy, Veterans Affairs, and other places within the state. So I've been at every base at least once, and I have spent the majority of my time in the interior, lived in Anderson and Healy, Fairbanks, and currently live in Eagle River.
So. All right, sir, thank you. I know most of us know you real well, and we've had people work for you and take you up mountains, so we've had a pretty good connection both socially and professionally. Are there any questions from any committee members? Representative Allard.
Thank you. I have 3 questions.
Okay.
And you could stop me if somebody else wants to chime in, but they should be quick and one might not be so easy. Thank you. And through the chair, General Sachs, thank you for being here today. My first question is, should you succeed as Lieutenant Governor, what would your vision be for election integrity?
Through the chair, the first thing I would do is sit down again with Carol Beecher and the Division of Elections to make sure that we have a good working relationship. I had a brief about 2 weeks ago and understand they are the experts on what they do. About 31 people, currently 10% vacancy rate. So I would get from the experts what their recommendations would be and to make sure, based on what I have done over the years, to follow the rule of law. I'm very familiar with protocol, procedure, and to make sure that I am doing that in the position should it happen. There has to be trust, there has to be transparency in everything I would do to make sure I'm getting out the word what would be going on and how it would eventually happen.
Thank you. Thank you. And through the chair, the second question is, the chief of the National Guard Bureau is looking at cutting 88 National Guard and AGR jobs. How are you going to address this issue?
Through the chair, it has been addressed, and I have a meeting with the director of the Air National Guard as early as tomorrow. But to put it in layman's terms, this is what's happening. We have what's called active guard and reserve positions. The National Guard Bureau is looking to take 80 of them. We're a small state. And the reason this is significant, the National Guard within Alaska is different in that we have all the 24/7 missions. Most states do not do that. So we have everything for the radars. We have CLEAR. We have Fort Greely. We have all the tankers, the rescue, the PJs, combat rescue officers. And if this were to go through, this would be a significant detriment, not just to Alaska. So I'm very clear when I say this. I'm waving the American flag here, not necessarily the Air Force or National Guard flag. We used to have the saying, top cover for America, and I want to make sure that we're still doing that. So I've met with all the CODELs. They've weighed in, all three. And I've also met with various elected officials throughout the state. I've talked to Alaska Federation for Natives, and everybody has expressed interest to help. But this is something that we do need to turn off, not just for the betterment of Alaska, but for the betterment of the entire continent.
Thank you. And I appreciate you putting all that on record. I think it's important that the Alaskans and really people nationally understand where we're strategically located and how important it is. So I hope you light up DC in a good way. Okay. My last question. Thank you. In recent news, the National Guard has seen an increase in pay issues among service members. How have you addressed this, and is there a path forward to preventing this in the future?
Again, through the chair, good question. I was taught as a lieutenant, there's two things you don't mess with, time off and pay. And so the day I took over this position, there were literally thousands of pay issues. And so I just checked this morning, we're down to a very small number and have been for quite a while. And the average turnaround time is 72 hours. So I have gone, I'm going to say a little bit old school. So for the people that have been in the military, if you remember the pay clerks, I have directed pay clerks to go back into the battalions in particular for the Army. And I've also made it clear that every single person within the chain of command, if anyone has a pay issue, it's your issue as well. Because think back when you were the young person and you didn't get paid. Can you afford groceries? No one should have to worry about their pay. You go up to drill, you go up to any type of military duty, you should get paid. So this is a very high priority, and I get a weekly update from the pay people personally as to what the pay issues are, and they've been very responsive.
Thank you, General Sachs. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Allard. Excellent questions, and I wouldn't expect no less for the answers to those. Thank you. I'd like to welcome Representative Johnson. Any additional questions from committee members? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. Welcome. Thank you for all that you do for our state. We're very grateful. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about when people are coming into the state and serving, how they are finding housing, schooling. I know we have some challenges, and just wondering if you have any some plans or thoughts about that to share.
There's a chair, and mainly those are folks on active duty, but we're all in uniform, and that's something that I used to do, and many people here in the room used to do as well. So what we are doing, we are working with the Office of Veterans Affairs to make sure that we treat, no matter who it is, no matter what the status, we'd like to take care of them. And as far as the housing issues, it does depend where you are at in the state. So I currently live down in Anchorage, and housing can be an issue in Anchorage. But the biggest issue is up in the Fairbanks area. For example, the guardsmen that used to live on base, understandably because the F-35s have come in, understandably because there's a potential to get more tankers in, that there has been an issue within the North Star Borough. So we take the input, and we try to, even though they're not directly in my command, to help them out as best that we can. And a lot of times that is just word of mouth. But for the people coming for the National Guard, by and large, my troops already live here, and therefore they've already worked out the housing issues.
Thank you.
Any addition? Representative Wright.
Just a statement. So as you can see, I think it's obvious, through the chair, it's obvious that why I admire your leadership skills, sir. Working for you for years, I think it's apparent that you're more than qualified for this position if it comes to it. And I look forward to seeing what you do with it. Thank you.
Thank you to the committee. In accordance with AS 39.05.080, the House State Affairs Committee has held our hearing on the appointment of Major General Torrance Sachs as Lieutenant Governor's successor. We're going to do a signature on a report, and it does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any brief sessions. So we're going to take a brief at ease to complete the report, and I'd like to welcome Representative Carrick to the committee.
We're back on the record. Alaska Police Standards Council, my old stomping grounds. The Alaska Police Standards Council has been established. It's under Alaska Statute 1865-130 under the Department of Public Safety, with the primary mission of establishing minimum standards for employment as well as conduct to education and training for the state's public safety and criminal justice officers. The secondary mission of the council is to encourage and the establishment of preliminary training programs for persons seeking to become public safety employees. Today we are reviewing the reappointments of three individuals to the council. We have Dusty Dumont in the room, Jeff Brown from Uktiavik online, and Ron Dupuy from Fairbanks online as well. And we'll start with Ms. Dusty Dumont from Juneau. If you'd like to come forward, please put your name on the record and tell us about who you are and your experiences and how why you wish to continue to serve on the board.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Dusty Dumont. Thank you for having me. I am currently the director of the Division of Pretrial Probation and Parole, which I know is a mouthful, so we refer to it as DP3. I have been working for the Alaska Department of Corrections for over 21 years and have over 26 years of DOC experience. Although I'm the director now, the majority of my experience comes as being a probation officer too, a job that I found very fulfilling. Although I appreciate my job now, I look back on that as great years of my career. I was born and raised right here in Juneau. I left Juneau just before I graduated from high school and I moved to Ohio. I went to college in Ohio where I majored in basketball and track, but I did come out with a degree in criminal justice. After I graduated from college, I moved to Washington State where I worked in a penitentiary for approximately 5 years until I gave birth to my firstborn, and then I moved back home to be closer to family. So I chose to stay home for be a stay-at-home mom for about 5 years with my two beautiful children. Honestly, the hardest, most rewarding work I have ever done. I believe that parenting prepared me to be an exceptional probation officer, be firm, fair, and consistent with compassion and empathy. I came back to the workforce in 2002 as a probation officer. I did have a brief stint with the institutions as well as the parole board. However, the majority of my experience has been with field probation. As the director, it's helped me have a statewide perspective. Alaska, not just with corrections, but also with law enforcement in general. Alaska is very diverse, and I supervise offices from Uktiavik all the way down to Ketchikan. Last year, when I was presented with the opportunity to serve on this council, I saw that as a great honor and privilege, which I take very seriously. I believe in the mission and core values of APSC, and I believe that my values align with theirs: accountability, professionalism, service, and character. I believe with my experience and with my personality, I'll be a good fit with the board. And that's all. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'll answer any questions that you may have for me.
Well, we appreciate that. Personality always goes a long way around.
I try to have a big one.
If we say go Buckeyes, is that in order?
That's Ohio, but I was not a Buckeye.
Oh, okay. Well, good. Any questions from committee members for Mr. P? Ms. Dumont? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw, and welcome, Ms. Dumont. Good to see you, and thank you for your service. So you've had the opportunity to be on the board. Has it been the past year?
Yes.
And can you share a little bit about your experience on the board and what you have seen as perhaps challenging?
Through the chair to Representative Story, what I have experienced is very new to me. You're looking at misconduct, you're looking at certifications, you're looking at things such as DOC brought before the board, the age limit of COs. You know, those are things that we're evaluating and taking seriously. I really enjoy the group and listening to how everybody collaborates and thinks about things. And, you know, a lot of people have different experience, so they bring different things to the table to learn from. Things that I see statewide are the need for training. Alaska is so diverse, and we have small pockets of law enforcement officers. And I think that when you work in a big department and you get to rub elbows with a lot of different people, you get different experiences. However, when you're from a small community, you don't get to really rub elbows as much with, you know, maybe senior people. Maybe you're all a little bit younger or newer. And I really see a need for training statewide and consistent and ongoing training. I think a lot of times we think that once we learn it once and they're good. But what I have found in my career is that repetitive things are what stick with people, and I believe that that's necessary.
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
Please.
And could you elaborate a little bit about what training possibly would be helpful?
Very good question, through the chair to Representative Story. I believe that when it comes to law enforcement, dealing with people, things have changed dramatically over the course of the years. We see more of a need to be able to use de-escalation. I think that's a really big one for law enforcement, use de-escalation skills and things, not just always dealing with things in force or, you know, I have a gun and a badge, but bringing the people skills and working with humans and communication all the way around. I think communication skills are necessary in law enforcement.
One more follow-up. Thank you. Yes. And have you heard people talk much about the Crisis Now model and how that interacts with the police and training? And when I think of de-escalation, I think of partly partnering with volunteers and professional police staff being there together.
Yes, through the chair to Representative Story. I am excited about the Crisis Now. In fact, I am going to a meeting in Kenai. It's either Kenai or Sedona. I think it's Kenai. Tuesday, we have a meeting that we are attending. I have had the opportunity to listen to people speak about it. It sounds like the Wasilla Palmer area really has a good thing going. And I believe that that is a model that other places can look at to learn from. I believe Fairbanks has started it. So we're all talking about it. And I believe that peer support is an excellent, I think that that is a direction that we need to promote and keep going with. And I believe that the mental health clinician, along with the peer support, will really be an addition to the people who are in crisis in the field. I think it's an excellent option for maybe a stop before you go to jail, or even maybe if jail is not even an option, but just an option for officers to lean on in trying to deal with people who are in crisis.
Thank you.
I'd like to welcome Representative Carpenter to the committee. And Mr. Bond, I'd like to also say, you know, as a former director for the Alaska Police Standards Council, the responsibilities you have really are somewhat overwhelming. I don't know how many people are aware of this, but you're responsible for basically 54 police departments throughout the state, training, certification, troopers, corrections. It's a big lift out there, and so the responsibilities to maintain certification and training is extremely valuable. And relative to Representative Story's comments, staying updated on a lot of that training, it makes a world of difference. And right now, the psychological effects that we're seeing within the community itself for the demands of the job, and then the ongoing training just to keep up with where we're at in the 21st century is very demanding. So we appreciate your time. Any additional questions from committee members? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll move on. Jeffrey Brown, you're in Uktiavik. If you're online, would you please introduce yourself and provide your testimony?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, my name is Jeff Brown. I'm currently the chief of police for the North Slope Borough Police Department. I've been serving as the chief of police up there since it would have been early 2018 is when I took over as chief of police. I've got 24 years of law enforcement experience in total, about 18 years of law enforcement experience here in Alaska. Started my career in 2006 for Alaska in the North Slope Borough and then left and went to work for the Department of Public Safety, their Office of Professional Standards, when that was first stood up back in 2009. Worked as both an administrative investigator and then later supervised that unit before I left in late 2017 to return to the North Slope Borough as deputy chief, and then a few months later bumped up to chief there. I've got a family, wife and son, currently live full time in Utqiagvik, happen to be down in Anchorage right now, just getting ready to transport some department vehicles up north again. But let's see, just love being up there, love the lifestyle. Again, love law enforcement here in the state as well. It's very unique and phenomenal opportunities. This, if confirmed, would be my second term for Standards Council, and definitely look forward to continuing to serve if given that opportunity. I take that position very serious, both with my work formerly with the Professional Standards Unit, as well as the Chief of Police, having to be kind of the safeguard, making sure that we not only help work and keep the standards up to date, but you know, moving with the times as communities change, we have to change with that. That's all I have. Pending any questions, thank you.
All right, Mr. Brown, thank you. Questions from the committee members. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Brown. Thanks for your service. I guess I just have two kind of broad questions. Since you've had time on the council already, maybe give me one thing that you're proud of that has happened or occurred in your time of service there on the council, and maybe one thing that you would like to keep, work on improving.
So proud of, again, I came on kind of tail end of COVID, so it was reestablishing kind of the training standards. Again, we all know training is super important. If we're not staying up to date with what's going on in our profession, as fast as things are changing, we're definitely falling behind. Certainly the challenges that we face with COVID and kind of reestablishing face-to-face trainings, some of the financial opportunities to be able to support that through the Standards Council was definitely beneficial to all of us in the state. One of the things that I would like to see kind of change that we are currently kind of working towards and having those discussions, again, we're currently, if we have a currently certified police officer, or corrections officer in the state of Alaska that has done something pretty egregious, we don't have any way to suspend or, you know, temporarily hold their certification status for the state. Essentially, it's either you're certified or you're revoked. There is no real in between. So coming up with some kind of in-between measures to be able to put kind of safety protocols, so to speak, in place for our citizens, I think, is a very important tasking to kind of continue to work towards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Brown, for your testimony. Next, we have Ron Dupree from Fairbanks. If you'd like to put yourself on the record, please, and introduce yourself.
Yes, sir. Thank you. My name is Ron Dupree. I was born and raised here in Fairbanks. Began my law enforcement career back in 1999 with the state troopers as a fish and wildlife aide. Moved to Dutch Harbor with the troopers and worked on the Stimson out there, patrol boat that they had. Worked out there until getting hired with the Unalaska Department of Public Safety in 2002. Then came back to Fairbanks in 2005, where I worked through the ranks, officer, sergeant, lieutenant, and I became the chief about 3 years ago. I was appointed to the APSC board mid last year when the chief from Juneau retired and took a different position. So I have some minimal time on the board so far, but really see the need for the work that the board does, and I'm excited to come back for another term.
Any questions from committee members? Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair Shaw, and thank you, Mr. Dupree, for your willingness to serve. You said you were looking forward to coming back onto the council. Can you tell me what you are hoping to work on, and then any challenges that you have seen so far in your time there?
Yes, through the chair. Chief Brown stated, one of the biggest issues that I see is the ability of the agency not to be able to suspend officer certification. So basically, if an officer has a issue that goes in front of the board doesn't have any authority to suspend the license at this time so that the officer can continue to work in that capacity up until there's a administrative law judge makes a decision on whether or not that certification can be revoked. So I see that as an issue. Some of the other issues that I see in the state are recruiting and retention for qualified police officers. Obviously, our retirement system change in 2006, going from a defined benefit to a defined contribution, has created some hiccups for departments to be able to retain qualified applicants or qualified officers. So I see that as an issue, as well as we're walking through some of the recent legislation changes in legalizing marijuana and how that affects police officers within the state. There's still restrictions on some of those. So working through what those rules and regulations look like, I think, are some of the challenges that we face.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter. Thank you. And another broad question, we kind of identified with one of the other interviewees, the concept of improving communication. And I would just like to ask maybe a strategy question on how would you advise the improvement of communication throughout the law enforcement community, and what strategy would be used to get better at communicating?
Maybe can I get some clarification on the question? Communication with other agencies, or where exactly are you looking?
Sorry, yeah, maybe that was a little vague. The two previous interviewees, as I just came in, was talking about communication being an important thing for police officers, and I think it's more interpersonal communication skills is what I took from that conversation. So if that's important for police officers to be good communicators, what kind of a strategy would you recommend for improving that?
I got you. Yes. I can speak from the Fairbanks Police Department. We have several training classes that we provide to our officers. One of them is called verbal judo, and it's basically a form of communication that's taught to a lot of law enforcement officers. When we hire a new officer, we put them through that. There's a two-day class, and then there's a refresher class, and we provide that to our officers on an annual basis, the refresher class. So if we hire a new officer, we put them through the initial training, and then we'll put them through the refresher every year. We try and open that up to other agencies. We have 5 law enforcement agencies in the Fairbanks area here. We have the airport, UAF, Fort Wainwright, FPD, and then AST as well. So from a department head standpoint, we try and open up as many trainings as possible to get as many local law enforcement officers through those training programs as possible. And I think statewide, we need to continue to do that. And APSC is a asset. They provide funds for those training opportunities sometimes, and we get a lot of officers trained that way.
Follow up.
From your time on the APSC, has the committee talked through improvement of communication during your time of service?
I've only been through two of the meetings, so I don't believe we've talked about that up to this point, but I know that it is a agenda item that several members are interested in bringing forward.
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Dupuy and Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yeah. I see no other committees. I'd like to do this one degree of separation of law enforcement and corrections community, Mr. Dupuy. John Lucking?
Yes, sir. He's the chief that hired me when I was in on Alaska.
Yeah, as far out as we are, we all know each other, don't we?
Yes, sir.
Okay. With no additional questions, I'd like to take any of these and complete the report if we could. Back on the record, Alcohol Beverage Control Board. The Alcohol Beverage Control Board was established by Alaska Statute 0406010 under the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to oversee the state's policies regarding the manufacture, distribution, and sale of alcoholic beverages in the state. Today, we're reviewing the reappointment of two individuals to that board.
Janice Hill of Haines, and Diane Thompson of Anchorage. They're both appearing before the committee via teleconference. And if we could, we're going to start with Ms. Janice Hill. Ms. Hill, welcome. And if you would, put your name on the record and introduce yourself and your qualifications, please.
Thank you, and good afternoon. My name is Janice Hill. I live in Haines, Alaska. I'm a lifelong resident of Haines, and I have been serving on the Alcohol Beverage Control Board for just about 2 years and have thoroughly enjoyed it. I have a long history of service to my community. I've been the mayor of the Haynesboro 4 times, served on the school board and numerous committees and boards in the community and in the region. One of the highlights for me in serving on this board is I was asked many years ago, and I can't remember how long ago, to serve. I was serving on the Alaska Native Health Board, and I was asked to serve on the committee for the Title IV rewrite of these statutes. And I served in that capacity for a couple of years and then was no longer on the ANHB, so was not active with the Title IV rewrite. Then a few 3 years ago, I was informed that there was an opening on this committee, and I put my name forward and was very pleased to be appointed because it gave me the opportunity to continue working on a project that I had started. You missed a few years in the middle, but now I'm seeing the results of the work that we started when I was first working on the Title IV rewrite. And now we're working with the legislature, making changes, and things are going back and forth, and it's just been very rewarding for me to be able to serve at this end of this project. My experience includes, I'm currently serving again on the search board. I'm on the Southeast Conference Board of Directors. I have recently joined the Haines Assisted Living Board of Directors, and I am currently the president of the Haines branch of the Alaska Miners Association, and most recently have been appointed to the Tongass Federal Credit Union Supervisory Committee, and I have yet to attend a meeting of that organization, but I'm really looking forward to that and some of the challenges that it might present as it's a completely new kind of board for me to serve on.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. What I'd like to do is go through some qualifications and then open up for questions. And what this is a formality, Ms. Hill. So these questions, if you could just answer them, please. Do you hold a wholesale alcoholic beverage license?
No.
Are you an officer, agent, or employee of a wholesale alcoholic beverage enterprise?
No.
Are you a member of a board that may not hold any other state or federal office, either elective or appointive?
No.
Do you hold any other state or federal office?
No.
Thank you. I'd like to open it up for questions from the committee. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair, and thank you, Ms. Hill, for serving and continuing to serve. You mentioned being involved in the Title IV rewrite process, and I was just curious if you had a comment on what you would say has maybe been the biggest benefit you've seen since that Title IV rewrite passed, and what are some positive impacts you're seeing?
I'm not sure. I think some of the positive impacts most recently in Haines, a couple of our businesses had to close their tasting rooms, and they had to close their businesses at 8 o'clock in the evening. And now that's been extended to 9 o'clock, and an hour doesn't seem like a lot, but for these couple of businesses, I have gotten nothing but positive feedback about, thank you for giving us another hour. So locally, that's been one that I've gotten comments on. So I think that's been a rewarding kind of comment to get from some work that we did. I think the main thing that I've really gained from this is learning the process. It's been very interesting to me just to see what it takes to make changes to state statutes. So that's been kind of exciting and just very interesting for me.
Follow up.
Thank you, through the chair. And Ms. Hill, are there downsides or particular negatives you'd want to highlight from what you're seeing in that and just what you kind of hope to accomplish on the ABC board going forward?
I really don't see any downsides in serving on the board. It's taken a little while to be able to attend meetings in person because of weather, and getting in and out of Haines sometimes can be kind of challenging. So it's taken a while to get to know the board members, and I think that we work very well together. We have good conversations. We're able to debate things. We don't always agree, but we're always it's a very respectful board, and the staff is wonderful. I think that one of the perspectives that I hope that I bring to this board is the perspective of what some of our decisions, how some of our decisions may impact a smaller community. Haines is much smaller than most of the other communities that are represented on this board, and I think that I'm hopeful that I'm bringing that perspective to the board as we make decisions.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Ms. Hill. Thank you for being with us. I'm looking at your resume here, and it says that you're currently retired. Congratulations. It also says listed there as a small business owner, and I was wondering if you are still currently a small business owner, and you might describe what it is that you do there.
I am currently retired, but I'm not very good at it. I have a summer job that starts on April 15th, working in the visitor industry. I no longer have my small business. I had a bead and jewelry store for about 6 years, and it was mostly for fun because I'm a beader.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw, and welcome, Ms. Hill, and thank you very much for all that you do for the Haines community. I had a question when you were talking a little bit about you were looking forward to continuing on the board and that there was a project or some projects that you were interested in continuing your work on. Could you elaborate about that a little bit?
Mainly, I'm not sure how much I can clarify, but mainly I just am enjoying continuing this process, working, to review the things that we've sent forward to the legislature during the rewrite process, and just, getting the feedback back, and especially listening to the public when they've got comments about some of the changes. And I think one of the things that has been kind of exciting for me is I have reached out to some of our business owners here that have alcohol licenses, and they're actually getting more involved. I've never seen Haines, the community, be very involved with what the licensing part of our businesses that handle alcohol, and now they are. They're paying attention, and I get comments from business owners that have read an email that they got from us about something that was being changed, and some, the announcements about public hearings and public comment periods. All of those things are exciting to me to be a part of.
Thank you for that.
Any additional questions? Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hill, for your presentation. But we're going to go next to Ms. Thompson, Ann Thompson from Anchorage. If you'd like to put yourself on the record and provide your testimony, please.
Yes, hello, this is Diane Thompson. Excuse me. Thank you for this opportunity. I have been on the Alcohol Beverage Control Board for 3 years and am anxious to get reappointed. Well, I've been reappointed. I'm anxious to get confirmed. We've done a lot of work over the last 3 years with the, like Jan was saying, with the Title IV rewrite, and a lot of really, really good changes to the industry. My background in the restaurant business for the last 40 years. Right now, I'm one of the owners of Firetap Ale House and Restaurant in South Anchorage, and formerly I was one of the founders and owners of Humpy's Great Alaskan Ale House downtown. Being on the board has really given me a lot of good perspective on what's going on the rest of the state, not just Anchorage. And the AMCO board has a wonderful staff, a wonderful director. We have a really, really good board that works well together, and just looking forward to opportunity of staying on it for another 3 years.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. I'm going to go through some specifics, if I could, if you could just answer yes or no to these questions, and we'll get on to questions and answers from the committee. Do you hold a wholesale alcohol beverage license?
No.
Are you an officer, agent, or employee of a wholesale alcoholic beverage enterprise?
No.
A member of the board may not hold any other state or federal office, either elective or appointed. Do you hold any other state or federal office?
No.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Seeing no questions, I will say 907 is in my neighborhood. You guys have some really good burgers there. We appreciate it. All right, Ms. Thompson.
I don't own 907. I own Firetap.
Firetap. Even better. Okay. That looks like all we have for the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. And we're going to do a brief at ease to complete the report. Marijuana Control Board. The Marijuana Control Board is established by Alaska Statute 1738080 under the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to oversee the state's policies regarding the manufacture, distribution, and sale of marijuana in the state. Today we're reviewing the appointment of Bailey Stewart of Wasilla to that board. Mr. Stewart, if you could please put yourself on the record.
For the record.
I'm sorry. I need to just get here real quick. My apologies. Yes. Ms. Stewart, could you put yourself on the record and introduce yourself, please?
For the record, my name is Bailey Stewart. Good afternoon, Chair Sean, House State Affairs Committee members. I am the owner of Green Jar, a cannabis retail located in Wasilla and Palmer. My retail was the first to be approved cannabis retail in Matanuska-Susitna Borough. I am also an adjunct professor at the University of Anchorage, Alaska, teaching and creating their cannabis curriculum. I serve on the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association Board as the chair of the Public Relations and Governance Committee. But most importantly, I possess a deep knowledge of our current and past regulations. I understand why we have regulations. I know the purpose they serve and was there for the conversations behind those regulations from inception. I look forward to the opportunity to uphold statutes and regulations with public health and safety in mind. I care about the future vitality of this industry in the state of Alaska, and I am honored to be here today with you. I'm looking forward to having the opportunity to serve my industry, and I'm open to any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart. Appreciate it. Any questions from committee members? Seeing none. Thank you, Ms. Stewart, for your introduction. And again, I'd like to highlight the signature on the report that we are about to take does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals. We're going to take a brief at ease to sign the report. Back on the record, State Board of Parole. The Alaska Board of Parole is established by Alaska Statute 3316020 under the Department of Corrections to serve as the parole authority of the state and to consider the suitability of parole for prisoners who are eligible for discretionary parole or special medical parole. Today we're reviewing the reappointment of Richard Ole Larson of Wasilla. He's appearing before the committee today via teleconference. Mr. Larson, welcome. Please put your name on the record and tell us about your qualifications and your experience.
Thank you. My name is Richard Ole Larson. I go by Ole Larson. I have a bachelor's of science in biology. Also, I'm a certified high school teacher from the University of Alaska at Anchorage. I got my BS at University of Nebraska at Omaha. I started in the Department of Corrections in 1976 as a youth counselor at McLaughlin Youth Center when corrections and youth were on a division under Health and Social Services. I went into the Department of Corrections in 1980 as a correctional officer. I served in corrections as a correctional officer, a facility administrator, a sergeant. I served as an assistant warden or assistant superintendent in seven different facilities and a superintendent in two different facilities and retired in 2005. I then worked various jobs off and on. And in 2008, I ran for school board at Matanuska Susitna Borough School District and was elected. I've been on that board ever since. I was appointed to the parole board in 2010, served 2 5-year terms. In 2020, I was not reappointed. So I went and worked for a group called the Nakamoto Group, who audited correctional facilities through the nation that housed undocumented immigrants. We would go in with a team of five to do the audit. In 2022, I was reappointed to the Department of Corrections, and I'm now up for reappointment for another 5 years.
All right, Mr. Larson, thank you. I'm going to ask you a direct question, if I could, please, as a formality, and then we're going to open it up to questions. One of the criteria listed in AS 33-16-030 Section C is that no member of the board may be an officer or employee of the state. Can you please confirm that you are not an officer or employee of the state at the present time?
No, I'm not.
All right, thank you. I'll open it up for questions to the committee. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Mr. Larson for volunteering to serve and for your work. I just was curious, what are some of the goals that you have for your time on the parole board? And an additional question is, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges facing parolees in Alaska, broadly speaking, right now?
Well, my goals, being a past certified high school teacher and working at McLaughlin Youth Center for 6 years, my goals in education is to get our kids well-educated, either in the trades or college-ready or work-ready, so when they walk across the podium, they're not looking for something to do. They don't have idle time, and they don't fall into the pitfall of drugs and alcohol. The major issue facing the state is 85% of our offenders have a drug or alcohol issue. So we, one of our big goals on the parole board is to get more substance abuse treatment going within the correctional facilities and outside, as well as other treatment programs such as anger management, domestic violence treatment, and batterers treatment. Those are the big things. If we don't want to release somebody out of a correctional facility in worse condition than they came in. We want to release them in better shape. And there's three or four different major issues that we want to release them with. We want them to be able to work full time. We want them to be able to have the tools to find something else that they could love besides drugs and alcohol, and how to get out of that cycle and get on what we usually tell them. We want them to get out, get off of probation, parole, and get on with life. And that's our goal in parole.
Just a follow-up. Thank you through the chair, Mr. Larson. And I really appreciate the focus on some of those preventative items to help folks once they are released on parole. What are some of the biggest challenges, though, and perhaps it's exactly the same that you see folks facing who are on parole? So what are some of the biggest challenges that you might encounter from parolees or be hearing from them?
A lot of the parolees, especially the long-term ones that have spent an extended amount of time in prison, is work. There is a few now companies that will hire felons, and that's a stumbling block. We're actually starting in the Department of Corrections. They're starting to work with the trades to try to get the trades while they're incarcerated, get the book work done, and get them interested in the trades. At one time, the Department of Corrections had corrections industry back in the 80s, which was a training ground. So when you walked out of prison, that you actually had an employable trade, such as in the culinary arts or in the trades itself. Or a lot of people got pilot grants and went to the university and worked on various diplomas so they could become employable. Employment's a big issue, as well as drug and alcohol. If somebody can walk out of prison with an employable trade, and they can go into a long-term rehabilitation program where they have sponsors and they have people to call up if they have the desire to use drugs and alcohol. Those are the two big areas for success for people getting out of prison.
Thank you.
Any additional questions for committee members? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Larson, for being here and for your service. Since you've been on the parole board, this might be a really easy question for you, but maybe not. Can you share with me your thinking on how you make a decision as to whether to grant a discretionary parole?
That's an excellent question. What we do, and this week I will get a thumb drive in the mail today, we have 57 hearings starting April 1st. On the thumb drive will be 57 files, anywhere between 60 and 200 pages, that covers the offenders from all their criminal history on through. And then I will get on the Alaska ACOM system and also research there. So I become thoroughly briefed on each and every offender that comes up in front of us. I'll take notes and put them on my computer. And then when we see them in front of us, I at least have a history of who they are and what they need and what they have done in the past as far as rehabilitation programs, what they have done for work. I really like to look at what they did as juveniles, if they started as juveniles in the juvenile system, if they graduated from high school, and really look in deep depth what they need. And then when they're in front of us, if an offender has taken the has worked in rehabilitative program, taken the initiative to work, to hold a job, to do things like substance abuse, anger management, education programs, and then they talk to us about their application for discretionary parole, which indicates why they should be paroled, which is a solid release plan. Where they're going to live, where they're going to work, what rehabilitation programs are going to continue, especially with families and friends and everything else. And then we also take in consideration victims' rights, the victims of the crimes and the nature of the crime. So there is a whole slew of things we take in consideration. Then they have an interview with us that usually lasts about a half an hour, where the parole board members, the chairman, asks the first questions, and then he spreads them around to the different members to ask questions, and then we deliberate and make that decision. So there's a whole big menu of things that we take in consideration.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. I've never served on the parole board, so I'm a little bit ignorant here, but would it be possible for the members of the parole board to know whether decisions to grant discretionary parole resulted in somebody who changed their way, or whether they recidivated, if that's the correct word? And if there is a way for you to know, how would you characterize the decisions that you've made during your service as to whether you made a right call or a wrong call in regards to the recidivism risk of a parolee?
Well, when they go on parole, and parole is for every 2 days you put in prison, you get a day of good time. So parole is that good time. Discretionary is even earlier. And we have parole officers that, and probation parole officers that oversee them. And I will see, like today I saw preliminary hearings where somebody would violate their parole conditions. Violating your parole condition doesn't mean that you've failed. That means that you need a little adjustment. And in one case today, the parolee got into a fight with his brother. So they got disturbing the peace. And we had a long talk. He has an attorney. We had a long talk with his attorney, his probation officer, and myself. And we just set up another new plan for him to get out there and try it again. And the ones that we see that do not succeed are usually the law violators that get out and actually commit another crime. Those on discretionary parole are very few, because discretionary parole is such a privilege, and they get out so early, and they have such a solid plan. We generally don't see discretionary parolees coming back. If you want to talk about success, what's kind of interesting, it's a small state, small town as far as population. Since I've been on the parole board so long, I will occasionally run into, in the public, one or two people that I have actually paroled, and they'll come up and talk to me. And actually, we have friends of the family that I have known in corrections and parole. So there is a lot of success, but you don't see those. So what we end up seeing is those that fail or need an adjustment, but the successes are there. And the key to those successes, again, is work and getting off of drugs and alcohol.
A follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer, Mr. Larson. I guess if I'm having an opportunity here to discern as someone who's representing the public in a decision as to whether to grant discretionary parole, I would kind of like to just get, and this is the first time you and I have had a conversation, I would just kind of like to get a feeling from you on, like, maybe your success, how you feel your success record agreeing to grant discretionary parole, and how many cases, maybe in your service, have you regretted granting discretionary parole?
I think, over the 12 years that I've been on the board, we keep an eye on the police bladders and stuff. And I've only seen a couple that went south, and truly did, out of virtually hundreds. An example of discretionary parole, this run, we'll see about 12 out of 57. The rest are revocations where they have failed because of drugs and alcohol, or violated by another crime. So in any given year, we'll see anywhere between 600 and 700 total cases, and about 20% of those are discretionary. So for the most part, the board does an excellent job in selecting and we'll see a lot of those discretionary employees come back after 5, 6, 7 years and ask for early termination, which means we would grant them off of parole totally because they are successful. So that's where we see a lot of times our successes. If somebody puts in a 5 to 8 years on probation, parole, has no violations, working full time, has a family, we will simply grant them early termination, and they can come off paper totally from there. And that's, we see that on occasion. We call those specials, where they come back, they petition the parole board for that, and then we review that, and 9 times out of 10, we will grant those early terminations.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw, and thank you, Mr. Larson, for serving. Sounds like you've been on the board for quite a while. I'm wondering, as being on the parole board, what sort of training do people get on the board, and what sort of training does the board ask for? I'm just wondering, trying to get a sense of how you get support, I guess, in your role, being on the parole board.
Generally, when somebody first comes on the parole board, we petition to the National Institute of Corrections. They have a parole training nationwide. It's usually a week-long course, and we'll go to that. Then we will have individual training with our attorneys to talk about the legality of the parole process. And then our staff will bring us in and talk extensively about the parole process, as well as usually sit through the first hearing run or second hearing run before we get to jump in with both feet and actually become part of the parole process. We do an extensive amount of reading, and we look at also what other states are doing. But there is very little outside that can prepare somebody except the experience that most of us have working with offenders. Like, for instance, in the Department of Corrections, when I was in there, I took at least 8 to 10 different National Institution of Corrections courses, which were also college credited, as well as the in-house. That mostly prepared me for my role as a parole board member, because working with offenders and meeting their needs for not only incarcerated, but for treatment. So when they get out, they're in better shape than when they came in. Our goal is, when we release somebody, is not to have any more victims, and keeping our community safer. And that's what we strive for. And again, most of the training is from our experience and the National Institution of Corrections.
Follow up.
Through
the chair, Mr. Larson, when you have said that you've done some other, I thought you said other state training, do different parole boards ever look at, like, how are we doing with granting parole? And is there sort of a standard? Because to me, you're kind of assessing the system that the citizen who's incarcerated is in. Like, are they getting training, like you talked about, and wanting them to get more substance abuse training? You know, are we, you know, helping them to be productive citizens when they get out? And so do you have any sort of evaluation or assessment that the parole board looks at?
We run statistics like everybody else, and we have a lot of statistics behind it. And our grant rate went down when I came back, when I left in 2010 and came, 2020, came back in 2022, our grant rate was pretty low. It was lower. But that was due to Senate Bill 91. Which shut down Palmer Correctional Center and COVID. They seemed to go back to back. During the COVID period, all the programs, inside and outside, came to a halt. No fault to the offender, but now our grant rate's going up a lot higher. So you can see the graphs. As far as grant and nationally, comparing to nationally, I don't believe I've seen in my time a comparison between. It's not like you're comparing scores in a school district nationally. When I was in parole and when I went out nationally to my training, every state does parole differently. There is no real consistency and parole, because of the larger states with huge populations, for instance, in New York, they have two parole members go to the jail. One's reading the record and one's talking to the offender, and they'll make the decision right then and there. Whereas South Dakota only has two parole members, period. And they go from facility to facility and individually make those decisions. And then run them by a supervisor. In our case, we have five board members, and which is very adequate. We work well together, and the five board members have been together for quite a long time. And we understand the process that we're going through and what our goals are for the offender.
One more follow-up.
If I could remind members that we're not here to debate policy, and we're trying not to make comparisons with anything outside of what we're looking at, which is specific to the appointment qualifications.
Thank you for that, Chair Shaw. Just one more follow-up. So do you find when you are assessing with the five board members that you're pretty much unanimous decision on whether the person should have a parole or not? And just as I would think as a self-assessment, have you had to reflect and look at how often you lean towards granting parole or not?
We generally are unanimous, but not all the time. Sometimes we do split our vote if somebody, for one reason or another. And it's usually on a revocation, not so much a discretionary. We try to lean more towards granting somebody, especially if they have put out the work. However, we also look at the seriousness of the crime, and we look at would granting somebody on parole on discretionary diminish the seriousness of the crime? So what you're looking at is not the crime. If you have like two murderers in front of you, if you just look at the surface is one thing, but you look at the nature of the crime. For instance, last time we had a parole board run, it might have been the time after, but we had two different cases. One was where two brothers got into a fight and one pulled a gun out and shot the other. Okay. That was, you look at that nature compared to the other murder where it was premeditated. The individual had divorced, so he planned and executed his wife and his wife's boyfriend in the house with children there. So you look at the nature of the crime, and then you figure if you release that individual would it diminish the seriousness of the crime and the victims of that crime? Because what we would have in that second case is now victims coming up in front of us and telling us what that crime did to them. So that crime happened 20-some years ago, and the victims that were children, now adults, are talking about that crime as if it happened yesterday. And the fact that they can't sleep, in one case in particular, said they can't sleep in the house alone. They always have to have somebody. They have this massive security around their home. So you got to also consider that when you go for a discretionary parole versus the two brothers that got into fight and really did not have an intent to kill the other, but in a heat of passion did so. And in that case, we had family members testify that that was a heat of passion, and like especially the mother wanted the child back out of prison because she lost not only the one child to death, but lost the other child to prison. So you take those into consideration also.
Mr. Larson, we appreciate your testimony. We've got quite a bit of additional business to do here today, and we appreciate everything that you have put before us today. But I'm going to ask you a specific question specific to our criteria as a formality. One of those criteria listed is AS 3316-030C. Is that no member of the board may be an officer or employee of the state? Can you please confirm that you are not an officer or employee of the state?
I am not.
All right. Thank you. And with that, we are going to take it easy to complete the report. Personnel Board is next. Personnel Board is established by Alaska Statute 3925060 under the Department of Administration to achieve the purposes of the Public Employee Relations Act and to provide policy, consultative guidance, and direct human resource service to the State of Alaska Executive Branch Agency. Today we're reviewing the appointment of Donald Hanlon of Eagle River. Mr. Hanlon, we've got you online. If you'd please introduce yourself, tell us your qualifications and your experience.
Thank you, through the chair. My name is Donald Hanlon. I reside in Eagle River. I'm a civil engineer. I work for CRW Engineering Group. I've served on a few other boards in the past, and currently I'm on the Alaska Commission of Post-Secondary Education. And I've been on the personnel board since early last year.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hanlon. I'm going to ask you a specific question relative to a formality. Are you currently an employee of the state of Alaska?
No, I'm not.
Thank you. And that comes under AS 39.25.060A. And thank you for that. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Allard.
Thank you. And through the chair, this is Representative Allard. Donlan, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Good. Glad to hear your voice. And I just wanted to say I could vouch for you to all these members here in the committee. I loved your explanation of your background because you're an engineer. You're just short, concise, and right to the point. So what do you think the one thing you want to accomplish being on the personnel board?
With the board, the other two members have a bunch of experience. Right now, I'm just trying to absorb everything. They'll probably hate that I will sometimes refer to this, but they have more years on the board than I have time on planet Earth combined the two. So being kind of a younger member and just getting on, I'm just trying to kind of get the lay of the land. There's a lot of documentation and other stuff that the staff has been really well with trying to get me up to speed with past agency rulings and all that stuff with statute. So that's kind of been my main goal of just trying to get familiar with the process and how things have worked in the past.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Hanlon, for your interest. This is Rep Story. And I'm wondering how your experience, of what you think you'll be bringing to the personnel board with your experience.
I mean, as the public member, I mean, I guess the experience that I have, I've served on boards in the past. I don't have anything, I guess, specifically related to personnel. I mean, my mom was a personnel director in Nome for the city of Nome, so I kind of had a little bit just kind of hearing stuff from her as it relates to employees and stuff, but I don't have, I guess, direct experience in that. I mean, I also do have an MBA from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and so I have, I guess, some business experience and stuff as that relates to employment law, a tad of that, but I would tend to defer to the lawyers that we work with on any of that stuff.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Hanlon, for being here. The paperwork I have before me doesn't tell me when you were appointed to the board. So how long have you currently served?
It was in 2023. I was thinking about that today. I'm not sure which one, but I know it was towards the end. I think it might have been in October.
Okay, and you had said that you are currently serving on another board or other boards, or you have in the past. Could you list those, where you've served or where you are serving?
Yeah, so right now I'm on the Alaska Commission of Post-Secondary Education as the public member. I was appointed to that in 2021. I'm also on the as part of that, on the Alaska Student Loans Corporation Board of Directors. I've been on that since 2022. I was briefly on the State Officers Compensation Commission. I've also, when I was a student, I served as the student board member to the State Board of Education Early Development. That was 2009 to 2011.
Very good. Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Representative Garrick.
Thank you, through the chair, and Mr. Andelin, thank you for volunteering to serve and for your past service on, sounds like, quite a few boards. What experiences do you have overseeing employees? Being the personnel board seems like a kind of a relevant experience. Do you have any experience with that?
I don't have, anything, I guess, directly. I mean, I'd have to go way back to when I was a student. I was back in way back in high school. I was a supervisor of a few employees at our snack bar at Mount Edgecombe High School. But other than that, and I wouldn't really classify that as too much supervision. I have, I guess, a little bit in my engineering background where I've worked with EITs and to direct them, but not really in a supervisory role as it would relate to employment law.
Follow up?
And thank you for that answer. Just the other thing I noticed was you're very politically active, which I think is valuable. I'm always glad to see when people are really politically active. If you have plans to volunteer work in a capacity during the campaign season upcoming this year, do you see that as potentially infringing on your ability to serve on this board? Since you were just appointed, it sounds like at the end of the year last year, and how do you hope to balance potential work in that capacity with your time on the personnel board?
Yeah, I've been politically active. I guess as it relates to that, I would refrain from, I guess, doing work on any campaigns or anything that is directly related to the executive branch. I don't see a conflict as it relates to the legislature. I don't have any plans to, I guess, assist anyone at this point. I kind of do it more out of friendship with individual people rather than trying to do it for, I guess, employment.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hanlon. I think you probably replaced me on the personnel board.
Yes.
So, once again, experience. There's a little bit of misunderstanding, I think, about what the personnel board does. They handle complaints. They approve reclassification of jobs. They all have to go before the personnel board. And I think one of the most critical things they do is they serve as the ethics committee for the governor, lieutenant governor, and AG, because they have no one else to do that. They also are one of the few boards that can't be terminated. And that's to protect against if ruling against the current governor, and there's, so there's no retaliation. So I think one of the most important parts is that ethics thing. And I will tell you, the staff is marvelous. And by the time the personnel board gets it, it's been totally vetted. You can ask questions. You can go through it. And they have the ability to hire their own counsel outside of the AG. So I think more importantly than, and I was actually running for office while I was on the personnel board. So in terms of being politically active, I don't know how much more politically active you could be. Once I was elected, I could not serve because that's one of the criteria. It is not a political board. It is one that deals pretty much with facts, based with attorneys, the ability to hire your own if you don't like what you get from the department. But that ethics component is very important, and I don't think people overlook that. And it's mostly reclassification, and there are complaints that rise above, you know, the administration, and then they come to this. But they're quite frankly few and far between in my experience. So I think it's a person that has integrity, that can listen to attorneys, and if they don't like what they hear, they have the ability to go get their own. So I think more than all the politics and all of the personnel experience, the most important thing is a person that is willing to can't be fired, first of all, so that's willing to go out and say what's right and what's wrong. So that's the person I want to see in the personnel board. And I think, I hope, I know the governor fairly well. I hope that Mr. Hanlon is one of those people. And I, you know, I'll give you a minute to comment about it, but I'm kind of, having never met you, I just wanted to kind of inform the committee what you will actually be doing. Is there anything that I said in there that offends you terribly?
No, I would agree with you 100% on that.
I have no further questions.
All right. Representative Allard, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Thank you. No additional questions from committee members. I've got a formal question to ask you, Mr. Hanlon. Are you currently an employee of the state of Alaska?
No.
Thank you. And that comes under AS 3925.060A. Thank you. And without any additional questions from committee members, we're going to take a brief recess to complete the report. Compensation Board. The last item for the day is to review the appointment of Anna Komata, hopefully I pronounced that right, to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. The Violent Crimes Compensation Board is established by Alaska Statute 1867.010 with the purpose of facilitating and permitting the payment of compensation to those who have been victims of violent crime. Anna Komata has been appointed by the governor, and this will be her first term. And Ms. Komata, hopefully I pronounced that again. Welcome. Please put your name on the record. Give us your qualifications and experience, if you would, please.
Thank you. My name is Anna Komata. I'm an attorney in Anchorage, Alaska. I've been an attorney since 2011, so about 13 years now. I've been an attorney in Alaska since 2012. My first job was in Bethel, Alaska, where I lived for 2.5 years, working for the Attorney General's office, representing the Office of Children's Services, and serving families in the community in Bethel. I then transferred to Palmer and served communities in the same capacity out in the Mat-Su Valley until about 2017, when I transferred to our torts and workers' compensation section, again, within the Attorney General's office, where I served for about a year, then transferring to the criminal division, where I had the opportunity to serve victims of violent crime. I was selected based on my experience working with child victims and child victims of crime, my capacity as Assistant Attorney General. I've served in that capacity for about 2 years, where I was in the sort of inaugural or reimagined version of the Special Victims Unit. While I was at the District Attorney's Office, I had the opportunity to serve on the statewide infant and child death review panel, which is created by statute. I've also had the pleasure of serving on many multidisciplinary teams and task forces aimed at serving our victims and families who are experiencing difficulty and children who are experiencing abuse and neglect in the state in various capacities at various times. I'm intimately familiar with the Indian Child Welfare Act, with the needs of missing and murdered Indigenous people, and again, child victims of crime. After that, I had the opportunity to serve in the Mat-Su Valley as a magistrate judge. For the past year and a half, I've been in private practice, where I'm very grateful to have been able to serve my community in other ways. I am a member of the East Anchorage Rotary Club. I am a board member on the Red Cross of Alaska board. I'm a trustee of the Anchorage Opera. And since June of 2023, I've had the opportunity to serve as the attorney member on the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. And just to, I don't know if you're going to ask any questions, but just so I have the opportunity while I have the floor, the Violent Crimes Compensation Board is crucial in providing victim advocacy and services that promote recovery and help mitigate the devastation caused by violent crimes in Alaska. Their work really contributes to a culture of respect, hope, and opportunity for victims of violent crime. And currently they're facing a devastating funding crisis. They are asking, and I hope that this reaches you in a different way, but and I have this opportunity, unique opportunity to advocate, but they are asking that the legislature consider shifting their staff allocation funding to the general fund so that more of the funding in the restorative justice account, which is, I think, was elevated to 13%, but then was decreased or is supposed to be decreased to, I think, about 9% or 10%, means that, you know, we'll only have about a quarter of what we usually have in funding to serve victims of violent crime and compensate them in the ways that we've been able to. And so we're asking that humbly that the that you turn your attention to that fund and ask that you advocate for us in shifting that funding to the general fund so that we'll have.
Ms. Kometa, could you please keep your issues to your qualifications and experience, please, and your desire to serve?
Sure. Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, my advocacy, Chair Shaw, does reflect my desire to serve on this board and not only be an advocate for victims of violent crime, but ensure that victims of violent crime are compensated under the statutory scheme.
Thank you. We have any questions from committee members? Representative Story.
Sure. Through the chair, thank you very much. I can hear the passion in your voice, and I just wanted to comment that I appreciate that, and thank you for giving us a good description of your experience.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Any additional? Okay. Without any additional questions, again, as a follow-up to Alaska Statute 3905080, the House State Affairs Committee has held a hearing on all of these appointees. And a signature on this report does not reflect an intent of any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any of these further sessions. We do have one individual online for public testimony, Ms. Lynetta Marcellus from Eagle River, and you're testifying on General Sachs. If you'd like to put your name on the record and provide your testimony, please.
Yes, hello. My name's Lynetta Marcellus,
and I'm not sure how many minutes I have, but could I ask the chair?
Yeah, if you can give us a couple minutes, that'll work.
Okay. I am a wife of an Alaska National Guard soldier who isn't testifying today because he fears repercussions from Major General Sachs. He didn't want me to testify today, but I felt the truth needed to be told about this individual before you make this important decision. I would also like to claim whistleblower status protection for my husband before I begin. My husband has had a stellar military record, an excellent evaluation report, resulted in a rank of 4th of 29 in his peer group. The past year has been a literal hell for him and myself, many sleepless nights and constant abuse by this command. The Alaska Guard has become a toxic work environment where the senior leaders institute a good old boy system. ADRs, which are full-time soldiers, receive preferential treatment and status at the expense of the part-time M-Day soldiers that make up the majority of the force. My husband's military career included 6 years of active duty, 2 foreign deployments, and 21 years with the National Guard. He's never left this state because he felt he was dedicated to the organization and Alaska, but it hasn't treated him the same. My husband had got injured line LOD and during an Army combat fitness test, and due to the poor procedures, processes, and management of this guard, he had to wait 3 years for it to be resolved. He spent countless hours producing documentation and evidence only to be passed from one person to the next and then notified after that it was late and he had to start it all over again. In the meantime, he had to use his own medical coverage to deal with the injury. Ultimately, this was only resolved when he filed a congressional inquiry through Senator Sullivan's office. Since Major Sachs has come into command, he has allowed Colonel Michelle Edwards to target soldiers until they have quit, moved to other state National Guards, or retired. One female pilot was targeted by her, and she finally quit her civilian job at Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and transferred to the Washington National Guard. Several other lieutenant colonels have decided to retire early because of this, and Colonel Edwards. Colonel Edwards, who wasn't even in my husband's chain of command, gained information from my husband's personal medical records, shared it with soldiers in his unit, and encouraged them to create a complaint against my husband so it would result in his removal from command. General Sachs failed to discipline Colonel Edwards for the HIPAA violation, even though the IG found there was enough evidence to bring before the command for a referral. She admitted getting medical information from a Alaska Guard medical personnel who worked for her as an AGR, then shared that medical information with Lieutenant Colonel Miller, who also worked for her, and then continued to collude with other AGRs under her to write up a false dossier, which was used to launch an investigation. After getting him removed from his M-Day position, she convinced Major Sachs to initiate a flight evaluation board to take away his aeronautical rating. My husband had to defend himself before a flight board against General Sachs' 4 JAG office prosecutors. These military lawyers took advantage of a soldier without law experience to make motions that suppressed evidence and exercised procedural nuances to hinder his defense. My husband had no one to defend him because General Sachs' lawyers failed to tell his trial defense attorney when the flight board date, and she couldn't be there to defend him. In an effort to force my husband into a black plea bargain deal, General Sachs used his staff judge advocate, Lieutenant Colonel Lopez, to threaten him if he defended himself before the flight board, it wouldn't go well for him. In an attempt to get the board over with so his flag would be removed from his record, my husband decided to go defend himself without an attorney. The flag should have been removed at this point, but instead, 4 months later, the flags are still on. In fact, my husband has been flagged for a year with no end in sight. This is not normal protocol. This has prevented my husband from taking 3 separate ADOS jobs offered to him in other states. Even though General Sachs has destroyed my husband's military career, he will not let him go because of the low manning numbers in the Guard and a need for his engineer expertise. My husband needed a tag release to transfer out of the Alaska National Guard, but General Sachs would not sign it. The toxic leadership is rampant, not only on the military side, but also the civilian side of DMVA.
As a civilian, my husband is in charge of the largest budget in the Alaska National Guard. There are strict fiscal law rules and regulations that come with dealing with such money. Senior leadership is not interested in those rules and sees them as strictly obstacles to their desire. My husband had pushed back on signing reimbursements, project authorizations, and documents that don't correctly obligate or disperse funds. My husband went on approved vacation for 2 weeks, and when he got back, he was punished for taking leave and put on a leave restriction, which is interesting because he said time off is his priority. While on vacation, he was told his future sick leave for shoulder surgery and military leave for exercise vigilant guard would be denied because he was needed at his civilian position. At the same time, while he was gone, Major Sachs signed a document which replaced him with someone who was willing to sign off on all these questionable financial transactions. Colonel Edwards also targeted my husband's civilian engineer job, asking his employees to give her information so she and Colonel Kelski could put a letter of reprimand against him. Not only should General Sachs not be confirmed today, there should be an investigation into these behaviors. Also, you should ask questions as to why there are certain investigations swept under the rug. And that's all I have today. I'm sorry for taking all this time.
Thank you, Ms. Marcellus, for your testimony. What I'm going to do is I'm going to close public testimony. And I'm also going to finish up with a report today, and we'll make this the last signature for the day. I'd like to thank all committee members today and all of the individuals who came before us for appointments. And it's been a good day. We'll just continue on. And we are now adjourned at 4:51.